we're going to get an overview on the governor's budget as it relates to tax policy. We have with us today three commissioners, the Commissioner of Finance, Revenue, and Economic Development. So who would like to start first? Commissioner Hansen?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Hansen. I'm the commissioner of what used to be the Department of Finance, now the Department of Municipal Management and Budget. With me alongside is our assistant commissioner and state budget director, Jim Showalter. We have provided a slide presentation in your packets, and our intent is to give you a overview of the governor's budget. I realize that I'm likely the undercard, and we'll get through my presentation so you can get to the more detailed commissioners sitting behind me. If you look at the first slide, a lot has changed in 2 years. Just wanted to provide a little context for those that have forgotten better times. But when we passed our 2008-2009 budget in May of 2007, it was a $34.6 billion budget. We had 2008 and 2009 was balanced, and we had, Mr. Chairman, if you remember, a $1.1 billion balance in the 10 and 11 biennium, then the out biennium, and it was even enough to cover inflation, Senator Pogamiller, if you remember correctly. We had an economy growing at 2.1%. We had 2.7 million Minnesotans working, and our federal budget deficit was $161 million, or 1.2% of GDP. Today, we are 2 years later, we are preparing our next budget. Our revenues were $31.9 billion. Our economy is now expected to shrink by 2.5% and possibly more. 51,000 less Minnesotans have lost their job, or 51,000 Minnesotans have lost their jobs, and our federal deficit has gone from $161 billion to $1.2 trillion at 8.3%, and that's $1.2 trillion, not counting, Mr. Chairman, the federal stimulus that is coming our way. It has remarkably changed circumstances. Rather than having a $1.1 billion surplus that we thought we were going to have preparing our 10 and 11 budget, it's now a $4.8 billion deficit. And you add those two up, that is an incredible swing. It's a $6 billion swing we've experienced in a year and a half, and it is likely with the macroeconomic conditions that we will see an even more of a downturn in a few weeks with the February forecast. That's the overview of the economy. If you turn to the next page, the governor's budget principles, first and foremost, to balance the budget, but also do it in a way that funds priorities in order of importance, to strategically position Minnesota for success in a changing world, and enhancing and expanding pay for performance, and the governor's principle of not increasing tax burdens on Minnesotans. As we put the governor's budget together, these important financial management goals in mind, despite the $4.8 billion deficit, Mr. Chairman, we put $250 million in the budget reserve to address additional economic risk in 10 and 11. We have retained and not touched the cash flow account for $350 million, so that's a $600 million cushion. The $350 will help us with any cash flow issues we may have going into the next biennium. We have understated the potential level of federal fiscal assistance. You'll see we have a slide on that later on, but we have it estimated in this budget at $920 million. It's very clear now we're most likely going to get more, but when we finalized our budget about 3 weeks ago, we decided to pick a more conservative number, not understanding at that point the interactions with the decisions the governor made. And then we, the structural budget, the 12 and 13 numbers, with the forecast was a $4.6 billion deficit. We get that down to $2.5 billion. So what is the bottom line? As we will show you, in this presentation, and as you already know, there's a lot of, whenever you use some of the tools that we have in our budget, it makes the story a little more difficult, and it makes an apples-to-apples comparison difficult as well. You will see, and we'll explain in it further in the presentation, the impact of the shift and the other items on Kelly. So it makes it difficult to put a chart like this together. But essentially, when you compare biennium to biennium spending, and this is not 10 and 11 to, you know, the forecast in December, but rather what did we actually spend in 8 and 9 versus 10 and 11, and you can see it's the governor's budget recommendations represent a 2.2% decline in spending going forward. What did we do? You can see on the next slide, it's a $4.8 billion deficit. We have three slides following this one that break each of these categories down further. Spending cuts and savings at 2.5. That's mostly spending cuts, as you'll see on the next slide. And the savings is a smaller piece of that. We have other resources, the federal stimulus, the appropriation bonds, tobacco appropriation bonds, and the school shift are categorized there. And then the governor's tax cuts net out at about $285 million. Commissioner Innes will talk about those in a minute. And then the governor's initiatives and the budget reserve. It totals $48.58, which leaves a balance of $11 million. On the next slide, spending cuts and savings, you will see that it's $2.368 billion. The $153 million reflects the merger of the Healthcare Access Fund with the General Fund. And we have a few slides later in the presentation that detail the spending cuts by issue area and in human services by category as well. But for now, I just wanted to show you the overall story before we got more specific. The other resources, as I mentioned, the federal stimulus placeholder will probably, that was a conservative estimate when we prepared our budget at the time. That will probably go up, but there will be some complex interactions that Mr. Showalter and I will talk about in a minute. You see, and you're very familiar with the K-12 and the property tax recognition shift and the tobacco appropriation bonds. And then the spending category, the new spending initiatives, primarily in the Department of Education, the governor's education priorities, $323 million, the tax cuts netting out at $287, and the budget reserve making a total of $860. So in essence, Mr. Chairman, we had a $4.8 billion deficit, and then because we're spending an additional $860, we had to solve that as well. What are the governor's top budget priorities? First and foremost, we want to enhance Minnesota's job climate to get the increasing number of Minnesotans who are out of work back to work. We want to improve the K-12 system, protect state public safety programs, maintain military and veterans programs, and increase government reform and accountability. The next slide I'll just breeze over because it involves the Minnesota Jobs Recovery Act, involves our efforts to provide tax incentives to stimulate job growth, and Commissioners McElroy and Innes will talk about that in more detail. In the next slide, transforming K-12 education, we do have an increase of about 1.9% in this budget for overall K-12 funding. Our goal is to transform K-12 education by the governor continuing his efforts to link future funding increases to improved performance, and we expand the QCOM performance to all districts and charter schools in Minnesota. Currently, 44 school districts and 26 charter schools use QComp and the achievement-based pay program. For districts not currently in QComp, They will be authorized up to $300 per pupil, which will result in a 5% increase in the general education formula. For those school districts currently in the QCOMP program, Mr. Chairman, they get the $260 per pupil. They will get the extra $40 per pupil up to the $300 level. The governor has a new proposal. It's the Pay for Progress initiative, which links K-12 increases to student achievement, and it's you get a certain increase if 1% and of 1% and 2% based on differing levels of actual student test scores. And school districts and charter schools, I guess I described that 2% per student on the general education formula for students meeting standards or showing reasonable progress toward achievement. So the next page shows you the pie chart, and as we all know, the majority, 85% of our budget is in three basic categories: health and human services, education, which can be broken down into K-12 and higher ed, and property tax aids and credits. That is 85% of our budget. When you see increases in two of those areas, like we have in health and human services, Mr. Chairman, you'll see the increase on a slide here in a minute. When we see increases in health and human services and we have an increase in K-12, that's a big part of the pie, and it makes, say, any kind of budget solution difficult for the remaining slices in that pie. On the next chart, just to remind you that our all funds operating spending is almost $58 billion. It includes federal funds, which I'm sure that percentage of the pie will go up here in the next few months, and the other funds as well. Now the next two slides, getting back to the difference in the story, when you compare what we actually spent in 2008 and 2009 versus what we're spending in 10 and 11, this is the breakdown that you get: about a 1.9% increase in K-12 and a 9.6% increase in health and human services. Despite the governor's recommendations for reducing health and human services spending by almost $1.5 billion, when you compare the actual spending in 8 and 9 to the actual spending in 10 and 11, and you look at it with this picture, it shows a 9.6% increase. And the other anomaly on here that you may have noticed, the debt service capital projects, 87.1% change. The reason that appears the way it does is we are using the tobacco appropriation bond proceeds to pay for the debt service. But now when you flip to comparing it to the forecast, the December 4th forecast versus the 10 and 11 budget, the numbers change. The K-12 increase becomes 1.1 because of the formulaic changes. But more importantly, the health and human services numbers appears as a 10.3% decline because we forecast, as you know, medical inflation as well as additional eligibility, and it was going to be in excess of a 20% increase. Now it's a 9.6% increase. So as you know, Mr. Chairman, when two people in the same debate can say we're cutting and increasing human services at the same time and essentially have a basis in fact for it. On the next slide, selected reductions, we wanted to break out the main categories. You see county aids and local government aids, as well as the U of M and MinSCU. I have a human services slide later on, but these are the main non-human services budget reductions in our budget. And then on the next slide, you will see the 12 and 13 look. The $4.6 billion, which was forecasted in the December 4th forecast, and to remind you that even though inflation is minuscule right now, this 4.6 and 2.5 should include some element. We don't include inflation in these numbers, but looking ahead, inflation should be factored in. And on the next set of slides is an overview of our healthcare program initiatives. remember back to the pie chart I showed where Health and Human Services and K-12 education make up a big slice of the pie, and Human Services is increasing, and we wanted to increase K-12 in order to fairly treat the other areas on the pie. We have recommended savings in the healthcare area. We do preserve coverage for children. We obtain better value in the chemical dependency program by tying spending to performance. We secure a better placement process for vulnerable children through the North Star Care for Children program. And we strengthen our PCA, personal care attendants, not the pollution control agency, but personal care attendants, reforms in that area to get at some of the issues that were in the legislative auditor's report a couple of weeks ago, as well as trying to address the dramatic increase in costs in that program over the last few years. You will see in the governor's budget a reduction in hospital payments, a 3% ratable reduction in long-term care providers, except nursing homes. The only reduction nursing homes will probably see is we repeal the ratable reduction language, rebasing language that was enacted in statute, I think, 2 years ago. We reduce eligibility for parents in medical assistance to 100% of the federal poverty level, and we maintain a limited state safety net program for single adults. We have, Mr. Chairman, the General Assistance Medical Care Program, which is a Minnesota-only program, and single adults without children qualify for assistance at 75%, the 75% of poverty level.
Commissioner, what is 75% of the poverty line in income?
For a single, I'm going to guess. $7,800. Yeah, about
$7,800.
$7,800. Yeah. I think the poverty level for a single person without children is around $10,500, something like that. There's the Department of Human Services has a chart, and I have one somewhere.
Thank you.
Chair? Mr. Chair, Mr. Hansen, on the medical assistance reduction to 100%, do you know what it used to be?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I can get that information for you. I believe it was at 200%, but I can double check that.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner?
225.
Any other committee members before we move on?
Oh,
Senator Dibble.
In answer to Senator Sunderman's question, I think it was 225%.
Mr. Showalter, maybe we can have that before we
check. It was either
here today.
What, it's low 200s, I think. Senator Dibble's probably right. On the next slide, Mr. Chairman and members, you will see the main reductions in the health care area of our budget. You can read Adults Without Kids, Minnesota Care, and General Assistance Medical Care. It's important to note as we move forward in our mutual discussions on the budget and as we look to the federal stimulus, that Adults Without Kids category most likely will not be influenced by a maintenance of effort requirement from the federal government. These are state-run programs that are not mandated by the federal government. So our initial read is we won't have to maintain a maintenance of effort on those programs. Minnesota Care coverage for parents, you see the savings there and the rest of them on the list that I've talked about.
Mr. Chair, members, just for the record, the previous eligibility level for parents was at 275%, for adults was at 200% of federal poverty guidelines.
Thank you.
On the next slide, county services reform, which will be of interest to this committee. We try to incent counties to consolidate and share services into 15 regional systems, primarily for health and human services type of programs. We improve consistency, service options, and predictability for participating counties, and it's designed to save money and to improve efficiencies and services. Commissioner Ines, Mr. Chairman, will be able to talk in a moment, but in our county aid cuts, We have, for counties that participate in this consolidation, can actually win back some of their reductions by participating. And Commissioner Ines can give you more details on that. Technology, we have four technology initiatives and a method of financing that better matches the benefits with the costs. We expand the number of licenses available online through e-licensing, and that's primarily professional licenses. We strengthen and improve the state data centers. Our data centers are spread out over a lot of different agencies, and this will allow us to have a better, safer, and more secure environment for our data centers. We are going to finish building. This is, I think, either phase two or three of our integrated tax system, a proposal from the Department of Revenue to modernize and make our tax collection more efficient. And then finally, replacing our outdated accounting and procurement system. The current system is entering the final stages of its life. It was put into in 1994 based on late 1980s technology. It has becoming increasingly difficult for us to use. And the financing mechanism is lease purchase. It is a mechanism where the money is made available up front. We sign, you know, we have a vendor who can build the project, and then we have another sign another contract for the financing. And but the difference being, rather than paying for all the costs up front, they're spread out over a period of a couple of years. It allows us to borrow to pay. These are, and we only do it for, we're only going to do it for core projects, core being identified as those projects that are important for the running of state government. The accounting and procurement system, for example, touches every agency. And we're allowed to do this. It does not violate our constitutional prohibition on bonding for technology. The next slide, just one line, minimal fee increases in the general fund. I think there's one human services fee for about $2 million in the general fund, and the rest, in the other funds, it's a conglomeration of various fees related to licensing that add up to about $30 million. So the total all funds is about $32 million. The governor's budget has a provision, $920 million, or $983, for tobacco appropriation bonds. It's equal to roughly 50% of the tobacco payments, and it provides one-time funding for non-operating obligations. It's a $983 million piece of our budget, and essentially what we are doing is selling. There are 17 states that have securitized their tobacco streams, and securitization is simply a state selling the risk of that future stream of revenues to an investor, and then the state gets the upfront payment to use as a one-time resource. The risk to that is the state is going to get less money because the investors assuming all the risk going out into the future that the payments will continue at the level that they are, that they're currently going. The state, what we are doing, rather than securitization, we are selling bonds and using the proceeds to pay the and using the proceeds from the tobacco stream to pay the debt on the bonds back. We look at it as not an ideal solution, as the governor has said, but as a budget tool in difficult times, and something that we, much like the budget reserve and the school shift, something we pay back as soon as we can. And it, for us, it's better than raising taxes or increasing spending that extra increment.
So, Commissioner, is there an opportunity to pay those bonds off early?
Yes.
In the governor's proposal.
We envision paying it back early and not paying it out over the 20 years.
But not in the next biennium.
Would love to do it in the next biennium. Mr. Chairman, if that would mean the economy is going a lot better than we all thought. The next slide, the federal stimulus package.
Sir, go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Hansen. With regard to that, Governor has. You used a kitchen table analogy. If I was a family, you know, borrowed money to fix up the kitchen, and then I was going to borrow some money to pay for payments, how would you not count that as spending? I mean, you're using these bond that you borrow to reduce your spending in the biennium, so it's not. It's reducing your spending to 2.2% reduction. But how does that figure into your calculations? I can't get my handle around the borrowing to make the bond payments.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoe, if I may, Jim Showalter, State Budget Director, and the transaction is a difficult one. In essence, what would happen is that the state would create these appropriation bonds, which would require a promise of or a deal in which we would appropriate funds over the next 20 years in return for some lump sum upfront money. That money would come into a debt service fund, not debt proceeds fund, not unlike our other bonds that are segregated outside of the general fund. When that roughly $1 billion enters that fund, that money would be only eligible by tax law and by Constitution, would only be eligible for non-operating costs. There's not a lot of non-operating costs in the general fund. Debt service is one of those, one of the largest and one of the only non-operating costs. So what would happen, and what's reflected in these documents, is that the money that's outside, already outside of the general fund, would basically be used to pay for those debt service payments in that year. That results in spending savings or obligation savings for the general fund because it had been planning to make those debt service payments. That's how it's reflected in the documents. It is an awkward transaction, and your confusion is understandable. But it is essentially saying that there's this revenue source that will be used to fund a cost that otherwise would have accrued to the general fund.
And Mr. Chair, so it's accurate to say that we're bonding to make bond payments or borrowing to reduce our bond payments. Is that what's happening then?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it is accurate that the proceeds would be used to make the debt service payments for this biennium and the capital project costs of this biennium, which are appropriate non-operating costs.
And then I think, Commissioner, I heard you say you're planning on paying them back early, not over the 20, but this is a 20-year bond you're selling?
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, I prefer to say we are bonding to avoid an additional $983 million in taxes or an additional $983 million in spending reductions.
Well, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, but either one of it's just semantics. What you're using is borrowing to.
Just my view.
Commissioner, but doesn't the proposal add to the long-term deficit? I mean, doesn't it reduce the amount of general fund money coming in and make our deficit in the outgoing years roughly $100 million a year worse?
Yes.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Hansen, so we're borrowing against our future cash flow and we're bonding. I'm wondering what is the risk to our bond rating that now we are not just bonding in our usual course of business, but we are expanding what we do in our bonding in order to pay our ongoing debts. Does that have a bond rating impact for us?
Mr. Chair, Senator, a good question, one that we have been trying to assess ourselves. The Commissioner and Assistant Commissioner Kathy Cardell actually were in the House Capital Investment Committee just yesterday discussing those very issues. In summary, I think that the bondhouses will, or the rating agencies will be concerned about the health of Minnesota as it, all other states. And right now, it is not a good time for any of our ratings, and that the outlook for Minnesota and other states has generally been downgraded to being more cautious rather than optimistic. This particular tool is going to probably raise some concerns, but as in her conversations, it is probably not going to be seen as an obligation of the state. At least two of the three rating agencies see this in terms similar to a tobacco securitization, which is really truly transferring some of the, it is not a full faith and credit obligation to the state. I would defer to Ms. Cardell to explain that more and how they're sort of parsing the different obligations of the state. But suffice it to say, we've been concerned about that and have tried to make sure that this is part of an overall strategy for looking care, taking care of those concerns.
Mr. Showalter, did I read just this week that S&P downgraded California's bond rating?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. California is in the process right now of issuing IOUs because they don't have the cash to make their operating payments. They're downgraded to A.
Mr. Schulte, to what extent are we running risk of downgrading the state's bond rating with this scheme? The fact that we're in 12 and 13, going forward, got a $2.5 billion built-in structural deficit without inflation, and now we're pledging an additional $100 million a year of general fund money to pay off these bonds. To what extent are we running some risk of doing that? Is there a way to measure that?
Mr. Chairman, there's always risk in deficit times, you know, in these type of times, and almost every other state in the country is facing the same dilemma as we are. You know, we don't get scored on. We're not going to sell bonds again until sometime this summer. So we're judged on the final end product. And usually at that point we have, you know, a fairly reasonable solution in the current biennium. And I have found they give you a little leeway in the out biennium because a lot of other states don't even look out that far. We get credit for budgeting out 2 years. And then even when we brief the ratings agencies, Dr. Stinson's always talking about issues beyond that. So while it's a concern, I think it's a manageable risk at this point.
You know, I think, Commissioner, when the state went out and borrowed money from Wall Street during the 81-82 recession, the bondhouses looked very unfavorably on that. And didn't it take us a decade or more to get our bond rating back?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Those issues, as I understand it, were cash flow.
Those were short-term borrowing, Mr. Chair.
That is distinctly different than what is being proposed here. But it is a concern, and certainly when we've talked with rating agencies, they've been watching this state and all other states for those kinds of cash concerns with the economy underperforming, tax revenues have been underperforming across the board. And it's been one of the places where we've been able to help them understand that we still were on solid footing, that we haven't had to slow down capital projects, haven't had to go out looking for short-term cash. And that's one of the reasons why we've been a AAA credit in two of the three rating agencies.
So, Commissioner Hansen, if the forecast comes on March 3rd, and I think we all anticipate an additional deficit in this biennium.
Yes.
What will the governor's approach be? Let's just pick a number. That in the current biennium between now and June 30th, we have a $200 million hole. What's the governor's approach going to be at balancing that?
Mr. Chairman, it is very likely by then we will have a federal stimulus package in which we will receive a payment in the current biennium that we will then use to pay off that 2008-2009 deficit. That would be Plan A. Plan B has yet to be thought up if that isn't available.
Thank you.
How can
Senator Pogemiller.
How can we use a stimulus package to pay off our deficit?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, it would I would presume, and again, the bills are, the House bill's been passed, the Senate bill will not. We have a hole in the current biennium. Some of the initial receipt of money would probably be the FMAP, Federal Medical Assistance Program money, and we could use that money to build back into the whatever hole we have and supplant dollars that aren't there to pay that program. The other alternative is additional unallotments, which we're getting towards the end of the biennium, and it was difficult in December to do it then. It would be even more difficult to do that now.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the fact that you're looking for all solutions, and this is one. I'm not sure I agree that this is a manageable risk. I think it's a pretty big risk. I think we know that we can't pay for all of our expenditures and we're borrowing against our borrowing in order to pay for current expenditures, and I think it would be a little bit more straightforward if we either cut our expenditures or raised revenues but didn't put the state at risk and its state budget and its credit rating at risk. And I'm just one of 201 legislators. But I honestly can't agree that we should be borrowing against these tobacco funds to pay our debt service. I think we should go back to the drawing board and look at that again.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, I am all ears. If anyone here on this committee or any of the 201 legislators in the totality has a better solution, if you want to break into the kitchen of families and tell them we're going to impose on you another almost $1 billion in taxes or another $1 billion in spending reductions at a time when people are being laid off, at a time where people are listening to the news every night, and are having that hopeless sense, at a time when even a newly elected Democratic president who is not raising taxes but rather cutting taxes, what kind of message would that send to our citizens that we just turn right around and raise taxes on them?
Mr. Chair.
You have a better solution. Love to hear it.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I've got about half a dozen thoughts running through my mind here at once. And forgive me because I serve on Senator Lanxess' Capital Improvement Committee, but I've forgotten what is our the bond service, the debt service that we're now paying. What is that dollar amount? I know it's I understand the 3% figure. I think it's probably over that 3%.
We pay, yeah. Mr. Chairman, Senator Scheid, it's about, Jim will have recite the exact number, but it's over $1 billion. It's about $1.1 billion per biennium that we now pay for service on debt of bonds previously authorized.
And, Mr. Chairman, if I might, then this cash settlement or whatever we're doing with the tobacco money, that's about that amount.
So $983 million of that amount. The rest would be used for debt service.
So, Mr. Chairman, if you go to the kitchen table and you look at you've got a credit card bill and you can't make the payments, you somehow manage to get another credit card to make the payments to pay off the one. Isn't this what got us here as a country? I mean, we're borrowing, we're taking on debt to pay off debt. And I guess, you know, Senator Moy's committee will be hearing about my stranger-originated life insurance. Death bonds might be a better bet, where you get make life settlement agreements. The one sure thing we know is that everybody will die. And with this budget that's being proposed, it seems to me there might be a few more people who aren't going to get health care. I don't know if we could manage to get the life insurance policies. But I just think this is not sound fiscal thinking to do this. And I know you challenged me for an idea. I'd suggest at the family table you think of maybe getting rid of the second car, selling, selling things or maybe getting a part-time job, adding to the ability of the family to pay the debt? I mean, I think that really is what's happening at the kitchen table. I don't think that people are just throwing up their hands and getting new credit cards.
Well, Senator Scheid, I think you're right. I think it's like we don't have enough money to make the home mortgage, so let's go borrow some money against our credit card so that we have money to make the mortgage. And Commissioner, I got to tell you, I just don't believe the people at the kitchen table are doing that, or I certainly hope they're not doing that. And Commissioner, I realize this is difficult. It's creative, but it might build a bridge to a to a balanced budget, but this is a very slippery slope we're proposing to go down here. And I know you've heard that from others, and I, like everybody at this table, will put their thinking caps on, and I hope by May we can come up with a better solution to balancing the budget than what we have in front of us today.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think the people at the kitchen table would like our solution, this tobacco appropriation bond solution, better than a state tax collector that works for Commissioner Inez showing up and taking money from them, or some sort of reduction that results in a lesser service. That is the, and, you know, when all the numbers stacked up, and Senator Scheid, to your point, we have been fairly and are fairly responsible in budgeting in this state. And I have always said it's a bipartisan. Whenever I discuss it with the ratings agencies, it is bipartisan. The fact that we have a cash flow today is, in these times, is remarkable. But I think that we have been responsible, but we have lost, as I said at the beginning of my presentation, $6 billion in the, you know, the difference in this biennium. This is not ordinary times that we're seeing. This is a once-in-a-lifetime. This is a, and we're trying to cushion the blow. You're right, Senator, or Mr. Chairman, it's not something you always want to do. You don't want it to become a slippery slope. But for now, in these times, and people hurting the way they are, we think it's the right thing to do.
Commissioner, continue.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langseth.
On the corporate tax cut, the day of the State of the State, I had a small businessman come to my office, and he said there wasn't a thing in there for me. Why is it that the governor thinks it's better to reduce the taxes of corporations, which in most cases are very large businesses, and have nothing for small businesses, which most of our businesses are in Minnesota?
Commissioner, if you want to defer to Commissioner Inez when he comes up here, that would be fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Inez has forgotten more than I will ever possibly know about taxes.
Mr. Chair and Senator Langseth, it's not that there isn't stuff in here that's going to affect the small businesses, because there are reductions in aids and credits that are going to put property tax increases in some communities across this state. And if you look at the small towns that I primarily represent, many of those businesses are the you know, the primary property taxpayers in those communities. So not only aren't they going to get a benefit from the proposed C corporation tax reduction, they're actually going to see significant property tax increases from the reductions in aids and credits. And maybe Mr. Inez or Commissioner Inez would be willing to address that also.
Mr. Chair, just to finish our presentation, the next page discusses the federal stimulus package. As the Commissioner mentioned earlier in the presentation, the Governor's budget includes an assumption of $920 million in direct state aid based upon the House package that has already passed the U.S. House floor. The Senate package also appropriates significant dollars for state relief. We anticipate that this number will change once we know the details of the final packages. This is at best a very rough, very simple assumption as to the impact of the state. There's going to be maintenance of effort requirements. There's going to be additional funds that may be available through matching funds or fiscal stabilization funds. But this is essentially a placeholder for us to hopefully get us to the March or late February forecast and and understand what the final package will be. Numbers that have been discussed in total often exceed $3 billion. I just want to counsel the commission or the committee that that may not all be available for general fund deficit reduction. There's going to be construction funds. There's going to be funds for local units of government, other entities included in that, so that the direct state impact will likely be something less than that.
You may have covered this, but is it your understanding that the payments that are coming from the federal stimulus package will come directly to the state and then be dispersed, or if there are funds to help school districts, will those funds go directly to individual school districts?
Mr. Showalter?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, we believe that there are certainly the majority of the funds coming through the state are going to have to be appropriated. They're going to come to the state for distribution as the governor and the legislature see fit. I'm not sure on some of the specific school district items if there's going to be a pass-through mechanism through the state or not.
Because, Mr. Chairman, obviously that there are payments made by the federal government to school districts,
yes.
And I think they do go directly to them. So there is a mechanism already in place. So it's not a complication of anything. It's just sending them to them so that, at least in my mind, the state would not be able to hold them up and make a different decision about them, and I would be very unhappy about that. I have another question, and that is we continue to hear in the Congress right now that they're hearing comments from whistleblowers about the Madoff Ponzi scheme and how they could have found out about it, 8 or 9 years ago, and the SEC apparently was reluctant. But my question is, because of the magnitude of it, is the February forecast going to reflect any impact of the Madoff scheme's disaster on Minnesota taxpayers, which some have said, is going to be the losses are could be as much as $2 billion, maybe not quite as much, but now we're hearing from, I think the gentleman's name was Margolis or something, that there are any number of feeder funds that may also impact Minnesota investors and cause them further losses. Is that being taken into account in the February forecast? Global Insight looking at that at all?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, we have we get the macro economic data from Global Insights on next week. But I know that Dr. Stinson and our staff economists were looking into and discussing the Madoff situation in December. So I think it is altogether possible.
So, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, so part of an increase in the deficit may be because of worsening conditions because of losses to Minnesota investors. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator S., I don't know if I can go that far. And I can have Dr. Stinson talk to you about it, but I know that he was having conversations and it was part of his thought process. I don't know to what extent, I haven't seen any of the data to how extensive it is. If you recall, our revenue forecasting has gotten more precise, I think in part because the economists at the Department of Management and Budget now have the ability to, I think the same ability that the revenue department has at looking at big tax returns. I don't have it or anyone else at finance. But I can check with him and have him get back to you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it just seems to me that, if there is $1 billion of losses and people are going to take them on their 2008 returns. Now, they probably won't be able to take all of them, you know,
right.
carry some of them forward, but it still could be a huge hit in the in tax returns that are filed for 2008, people that have been taking showing capital gains, and they're going to be showing huge capital losses, and they're going to want to carry them back as well as carry them forward. And I would think that the revenue receipts are going to be drastically affected by that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I would just reiterate one thing that Dr. Stinson mentioned at the time of the last forecast, which is there's a tremendous amount of risk in some of these returns that in individuals with losses that are accumulating, whether they can be returned in any given fiscal year, so that no matter what he puts out in this upcoming forecast, the actual returns, the actual collections in April and May are going to be of great interest to everyone, because there's a greater than usual volatility around some of these estimates.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just think we need to keep our eyes open on that, because we could, even if it doesn't get in the forecast, we could find ourselves in the beginning of the next biennium not having taken care of what may be a huge problem. And I would hate to pass a budget of any kind and then find out July 1 that we are millions of dollars behind, and force the governor to do an allotty.
Senator Rest, I think you make the argument for a budget reserve.
Yes.
Commissioner? Mr. Showalter, anything left?
Thank
you, Mr. Chairman. Senator
Pogomir. I understand that, Senator.
First, I think we should change your slides. The characterization that this budget includes a structural deficit, budget gap cuts it nearly in half. I think that's just not factually correct. We have roughly $1 billion structural deficit coming in this year. And this budget goes to 2.5 million. We're actually going the other way. We are not cutting the structural deficit in half. We're going the other way. You're saying it's cut it in half from a projection. I think it would be more useful to talk about reality. The reality is we're going from $1 billion structural deficit to $2.5 billion structural deficit. I think it would be important to talk to Minnesotans about that. So I
don't
think it would be better.
Can you say that? We're going from a billion? I don't know if I'm following, Senator.
Last year when we left, we knew there was about $1 billion structural deficit. This proposal is
okay.
$2.5 billion
of session. You're talking about the end of session numbers.
Yeah, the,
okay.
The reality. And so, Commissioner, as Commissioner of Finance, I encourage you, implore you, to in your presentations talk about things in that instance.
Things as structurally, things as factually as possible, and the facts are we're moving into a deteriorating situation, not a... This is not a plus, this proposal. And,
that's a good point, Senator.
Okay.
I understand now.
And then having said, and I think it'll help the discussion later on in the session, frankly. And then I want to pass this out.
That's a good, when you talk about context, comparing the end of set, but it's also important to compare the end of the 2007 session where we had $1 billion in the and now it's now it's
correct.
2.5.
Correct, and you did say that in your comments.
Okay, I understand.
And I appreciate
point.
It, but I'm not. I don't even need to go back, because I think that would be, if I said it, would be viewed as political. If I said, well, when Governor Plenty was first here, it was a surplus. Now it's a structural. I don't need to. I don't want to do that, and the reason is because I think the situation is much more serious than that.
No one
I really
ever
do.
Accuse you of being political, Senator.
There'll be plenty of time for all that, but in this instance,
okay, I get that's a good. That's a good.
But
point.
In this instance, we're talking about a very serious situation for our state. And we're going in the wrong direction. And I think
there is not an understanding yet.
And I don't. So let me just talk about the numbers without talking about individual proposals and stuff yet. If you were to solve the structural deficit that Minnesota has right now, based on our facts, and if you do it without inflation, and before the next forecast, which we know is going to be worse, and we know we're in a deteriorating economy, here are the budget reductions that we would have to make. And it's 13.65 across the
before
board.
Before the February?
Before the next forecast.
Okay.
Without inflation, just to get to the 4.8. This is a factual situation. The facts are that if we were going to get structural balance, which is what we should be trying to do here, we would have to cut across the board in some other manner $4.8 billion. And across, this is for illustrative purposes. This is not a proposal to solve the budget. But illustratively, to get to structural balance, it would have to be a 13.65% cut. That means $1.8 billion out of K-12 education, $1.5 out of human services. I believe that there is not yet an acceptance of the seriousness of the situation we're in. And I implore members and governors to get real quicker here. I believe we are going to be cutting K-12 education. I'm saying that on purpose, because now whoever wants to blog and accuse Senator Pogemiller of saying that, please do. Because that's the reality. You can't keep 40% of your budget lying. And Commissioner, I implore the executive branch to be more realistic in the next budget that's going to come after the more forecast. We are in a deteriorating situation. It is not in the long-term interest of the state to try to do this with bubblegum and act like we're doing something. It's none of our interest, and it's not in the interest of the state. I'm trying to be as constructive as possible. I'm not casting aspersions on anybody. We're way beyond that, way beyond that. I was here in 81 and 82. We are way beyond that.
Commissioner, to Senator Pogemiller's point, by the time the February forecast comes out on March 3rd, I think we all hope we'll know what the federal stimulus is going to be by then. Will the governor submit a supplemental budget to the legislature at that point so that, you know, maybe over the last month we've all gotten a little smarter and maybe we'll look at some other options? I guess my short question is, will the governor submit a supplemental budget after the March 3rd forecast?
Yes, it will. It will, in some respects, be easier than the January 27th budget, because we will know what the February forecast is, and we will have a better analysis of the interaction, the dollar amounts, and the interactions of the federal stimulus with our programs. So it is, and it would be my intent to. I would love to have Congress pass it and the President sign it as soon as possible so we can turn around a supplemental to you as quickly as possible, understanding what your deadlines are in April and wanting to get you the budget so you can look at it and make whatever changes you want.
And Commissioner, as you work with the governor putting that together, I guess I implore you to take more seriously the structural problem the state has. The $2.5 billion we're carrying as a deficit in 12 and 13. It is, members, it's just not acceptable for us to put a budget together this year and go home and come back 2 years from now and face another $2.5 billion problem. I mean, to go home and know that's what's on the horizon. We simply, Commissioner, we just have to do better than that. And Senator Pogemiller is right. The trend line is really troubling. When we went home in 08, we had $1 billion surplus. We came back a year later in 09, we had $1 billion deficit. Now, a year later, we're here, and even under the governor's budget, we have a $2.5 billion deficit. It almost seems as though we're in a tailspin down, and we've got to get our arms around that. So I guess my request is, let's take the problem in 12 and 13 more seriously in the supplemental budget recommendations.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we did take it very seriously. Yeah, I don't think there's been a finance commissioner that's ever served that one like to see as that has in their mind and their goal to have a zero or a positive balance. I was on clouds after the 2007 session when we had 1.1. I am serious when I say I think that in these times, the effort it would take and the impact would cause this downward spiral to go even more. Now, we will take your advice. I'll take it back to the governor. And if we're not able to accomplish it, I will eagerly await. Maybe you have some better ideas and how to fix that. We'll love to. We'll be waiting with open arms.
Commissioner, I think the governor has ideas, too. I just think, unfortunately, for whatever political reason, he doesn't want to put them out on the table. Because I think Senator Pogemiller is right. The state is facing serious, serious budget circumstances. It's going to require participation by every interest group that works around this building. And I think the sooner we get to that realization, and the governor could help bring us there, the easier this is going to be to resolve. And it's not going to be politically popular. But we all have a responsibility to manage the fiscal future of our state. And leading sometimes is not a popularity contest.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I will promise we'll have plenty of discussion. This is just the beginning. You may not like what we start with, but I think in the end we all agree.
Senator Limmer?
Mr. Chairman, does your caucus have a budget plan yet?
Senator Limmer, Senator Cohen and Pogemiller and I are going to start meeting today on a weekly basis. But I think before the Senate puts a proposal together, we need to understand what's in the governor's proposal. I'm sure the governor's got some very good ideas in his document and that the legislature is likely going to do, but we need to understand what they are, I think, first. Senator Pogue.
Senator Limmer, there will be a budget. We have to drop the partisan posturing here. This is really serious. There will be a Senate budget. It will include a cut in K-12 education. This without
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, a few days ago in the Senate chamber, there was also a discussion about a health and human service budget plan that I don't know if there was a plan for that either at this time. But we talk of posturing and we're attacking the governor on a proposal that I thought made at least sense for the long term. And it probably needs a little more polishing up for the short-term issues that we have. But at least there is something on the table to build from. And
obligated to put something on it.
I think we may be just a little too harsh on the administration when there's not a definite black and white plan from anyone else in the legislature. So if we want to get into posturing, we'll be more than happy to accommodate. But that does not solve the problem with the public. They're depending on us to solve this problem.
Senator Limmer, I think people need to check their partisan stripes at the door. The state is facing a serious fiscal crisis. And Senator Pogemiller is right. You cannot pull 40% of the state budget off the table and expect to resolve this if the governor's going to be unwilling to put any new revenue on the table. You can't accomplish the task at hand. And so, I mean, my request simply was, is the governor going to submit a supplemental budget? And if he does, and the commissioner said he was going to, that we take the problem in 12 and 13 more seriously. I don't know who the governor will be in 12 and 13, but coming here, running for office, knowing that the state has a structural budget totally out of balance, that your first budget you're going to have to cut $2.5 billion. Is not, I think, the work we want to leave for the next legislature and the next administration. I think we can do better than that, Commissioner.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to leave you with any illusions. The governor's supplemental budget will not increase taxes and will not cut K-12 education. I can foreshadow those two items for you right now.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Schein.
Mr. Chairman, I suppose when Commissioner Innes comes up, we'll talk about property taxes, but is there not a property tax impact, and aren't those taxes? And I understand they're local, but I know that those aren't the big spenders, at least the communities I represent. Do we take into consideration property tax increases in saying there's no new taxes, or no tax increases, I should say?
Never asked before.
Again, I'll defer to my colleague, Commissioner Innes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Scheid, but I think that's the debate we've had over the last 6 years. The decision to raise or lower a property tax is a decision by a county board or a city council. They make the decision to increase levies, or they can make the decision like we have at the state to reduce spending and prioritize not raising taxes. The governor doesn't raise taxes in Chisago County. The Chisago County Board does.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir,
Mr. Chairman, the things we do here have an impact on property taxes. I know that. I haven't been on this committee for a few years, but I think I have like 17 years of service on a tax committee in one body or the other. And I know that what we do has an impact on property taxes, and I'm looking at the LGA, the homestead, the market value homestead credit. Those cuts are a really big deal at the local level, and I just wondered if you had taken into consideration what the cost would be just to let people continue to have the level of service they're having in their cities today. And I don't think that those are the big spenders. I mean, they just aren't. The two communities I represent, Brooklyn Center and Brooklyn Park, have high needs and limited resources, very high property taxes already. And what we do, I just don't think we can get out of it. What we do here has an impact on property taxes. And at the end of the day, people's property taxes will be up if they want to continue K-12 spending. They need more. I think everybody here, in a totally nonpartisan way, thinks that our schools need more resources, not less, and they're going to have to go to the property tax. And I think, could I be wrong? One more point. I want to ask a question, Mr. Chairman, about the QComp piece. There's some levy there, right? Or is that all aid?
No, there is levy.
There's a levy.
Yeah.
So
a smaller. I think it's a smaller component of it.
Commissioner Hanson, I think maybe that's Commissioner Innes can be prepared to answer the question of, under the governor's QComp proposal, what will the property tax increase statewide be?
And Mr. Chairman, that was just my point, that we do have a direct, almost a direct impact.
Any other questions, members? Senator Senja.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just a thought. I think you can almost feel the pulse around this table in terms of where we are and how we're looking for directions in terms of where to go. But the governor's put his plan forward. You can like it or not, and whatever side you fall on that is probably fair. And Senator Pogermiller's offered, and you have as well, Mr. Chair, an effort to put forth your ideas, and that's fair, and that's good, and that's the way it ought to be. And maybe even Senate Republicans can throw in a few ideas, but I think we all know as elected officials that we need to come together on this, and we need to make this work, and it's not going to be easy, and there will be pain, and we probably know that. But as we go forward, I think we have to do it with your ideas, the governor's ideas, our ideas, and we can all like them or not, but I think we just have to accept them as they are and reject them as we might want to, but go forward in a spirit of good tone and cooperation.
Senator Sundrum, I appreciate those comments. And I can feel the angst in this room around the table about, I don't think any of us know how in May we're going to have a balanced budget that going forward is at a minimum, better than the governor has proposed. But, Senator Sengem, I got to tell you, when I hear Commissioner Hansen say that no matter how much worse it gets, no matter how much worse it gets, tax increases and K-12 are off the table. I would argue we've got to have everything on the table here, and we all got to pull together and figure out how we resolve this. And we can't take potentially big parts of the solution off the table and expect we're going to come up with some kind of a gimmick or scheme just to try and limp through this next budget cycle. We can do better than that. So, Senator Sengem, I appreciate your comments. Senator Ortman, I appreciate your comments. And the people on this table, I think we all realize we got some darn heavy lifting to do. But, Commissioner, I got to tell you, politically, that's a cute soundbite that K-12 and property taxes or the tax increases are off the table. And it might be popular. And the governor's popularity might go up a point or two. But we all got some really heavy lifting to do in this building to resolve a budget for the people of the state of Minnesota. And I think making a presumption that things are off the table, not knowing with a great deal of uncertainty there is just not fiscally responsible. And if you could please pass that on to the governor, I just think those kind of presumptions in this uncertainty might be popular, but I think we have to look beyond popularity if we're going to resolve this.
I will pass that on, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sengem.
May I just have one more question here?
Sure.
One of the things that, and I wish I had more information to recite, but if you live in southern Minnesota, you hear a lot of Iowa television, and as, for instance, state of Iowa, about 2.5 million people, has a $650 million deficit, and I can only wish we were there. And I heard Governor Rendell on television over the weekend and was talking about Pennsylvania, a $2.3 billion deficit. And so I'm sitting here kind of wondering what's different about Minnesota. Some suggest we maybe tax too little, and some perhaps think maybe too much. But whatever we are, I think we're, and I don't remember our ratings, 15th or something like that in the country. Just comparatively, though, do you have any thoughts as to why our deficit is as deep as it is compared to what I at least know in terms of some of the conditions of other states? And there may be 100 answers.
Commissioner, you want to take a run at it?
I will, Mr. Chairman, Senator Sengem. I think that in part, and again, as you referenced, there's a, you know, your answer to that question, I think, is somewhat related to what your philosophy is. It's our philosophy that we have to make Minnesota more cost efficient, a more job friendly place by lowering, as Commissioner Innes will talk about in a minute, as Commissioner McElroy will talk about in a minute, make this a place that attracts capital, talent, jobs, and the kind of jobs that are the 21st century jobs. I think that for every person in the room, there's probably a different answer. That happens to be our answer.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions, members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, you know, I think Senator Sengem's question is one that Minnesotans kind of want answered, kind of how we got here. I've been thinking and looking, and one of the things that occurs to me is we look back to the solutions that we've had, budgets, particularly the 2003 one. We use a significant amount of one-time cuts. Compounding the problem through the years. I mean, a little revenue increase kind of hit it for a while. But if we did learn anything from the last deficit, it's that the one-time solutions don't work. As I listened to the chair and Senator Pogemiller and others about the structural problem, would certainly hope that we would learn from 03 and not repeat that mistake this round.
No, we did use too much of it.
Any other questions, members? Commissioner, Mr. Showalter, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you.
We'd like to today invite you back after the March 3rd forecast.
I will mark it on my calendar.
Thank you. Commissioner Rimas. Commissioner, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Good morning, Chairman. My name is Ward Ines with the Department of Revenue. And maybe if it's all right with the Chairman, I could first respond to Senator Langstedt's inquiry, and I think Senator Scheid had an inquiry about QCOM. Regarding the governor's tax proposal, I guess the first thing I want to do is dispel a myth I think a lot of us have held over the years, and that's the myth that if you're a C-Corp, you're large. And that is just factually inaccurate. We have some data that shows there's about 48,000 C-Corps in the state of Minnesota, and 82% of those C-Corps have payrolls of less than $500,000 a year. So I would clearly define that as a small business. Alternatively, there's only just over 100 C-Corps that have payrolls of more than $50 million a year, which represents 0.22% of all C-Corps. So I think as a general rule, C-Corps are small businesses. We're fortunate to have a concentration of high-profile Fortune 500, Fortune 1000 companies. We all know about the 3Ms and the Medtronics and the General Mills and the Targets and the Best Buys, United Health Group. But the majority of C-Corps are small and have small payrolls.
Commissioner, Senator Rest took the bait.
Yes. And how many of those corporations with lower than $500,000 in payroll pay any tax? You know, any corporate tax?
I don't have that number in front of me, but we've done some analysis of that.
If they're going concerns and they have NOLs every year, which is possible,
yep,
as you know, they don't get any benefit from, they wouldn't care what you did with the corporate income tax because they are never going to pay it. But our large corporations, they pay it.
They do.
And I would guess that they pay the bulk of it. Far more than the number of them. So just because of the business organization that structure that someone chooses doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to benefit from that. And you know that, you know, with the LLCs and the partnerships and whatever, people look at the individual rate that they would be paying, plus, and they look at the corporate rate, and whether they would pay is the biggest decision they make, not what the rate is,
and Chairman,
or their organization.
Chairman, Senator Rest, I thought I had that actually with me about the breakdown, kind of by decile, but from size of corporations. And there's no question that the large global multinational corporations pay the bulk of the corporate franchise tax. There's no question, but there's more than 39,000 C corps in Minnesota. And I can guarantee you that there's a good number of those actually have a positive corporate tax liability on an annual basis. And we'll get those numbers. They may only represent a small piece of the overall revenue collected, but for them, you know, a substantial reduction in that annual tax liability is meaningful.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, it would also be interesting to know how many of those 30-some thousand have been in business for more than 5 years. Or if they are, and how many, you know, what's the switchover? How many of them, of the smaller ones, fail on a regular basis? And all they're doing is being replaced and not paying.
Yep. Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, good morning.
Good morning.
We had this conversation in my office. It was a very spirited conversation, and you had promised to tell me how many of the top, how much of the tax burden is paid by the top 50 C-Corps in Minnesota, and I think that's really important information for this committee. But one of the things that I'm concerned about is that, and correct me if I'm wrong with these numbers, but I thought you said that we have a declining revenue source from our C-Corp tax, that it was previously $1 billion at its high on an annual basis. It's now $650 million, so it's declining. There's no reason to think in 2009 that these C-Corps are going to have more revenue. They're likely to have less revenue and to contribute even less in 2009 just because of the economy, and less in 2010 because of the economy. You have to earn money to pay taxes. And we have a lot of C-Corps that aren't earning money right now. And so I wonder about the timing of this provision. I wonder whether it's our best, because it's not going to provide any real relief to Minnesotans. for us to start cutting the C Corp tax is going to take years in order for it to translate into jobs in our economy. And so I understand the governor that he's trying to fix the business climate. I get that. But this, the timing of this may not be the best.
Chairman, Senator Ortman, your question is a good one. I would say this. The governor's will stipulate to the fact that in the short term, in the 6 months, a year, even a year and a half, this proposal, if it's enacted, will not dramatically change the job climate. So we'll stipulate to that. But the governor is convinced that if this session is only about meeting our constitutional obligation to balance the budget, doing a little triage on the Economic Development Fund for a short-term benefit, we've missed the opportunity and really missed the larger picture. And he asked us to look at what we could do in our business climate, tax climate particularly, to significantly move the meter in attracting capital and ultimately attracting more jobs to Minnesota. And we, you know, we did our due diligence on this. So we looked at the literature, the research from public finance experts, from economists, and the evidence is very compelling and convincing that at the end of the day, the corporate franchise tax is probably the biggest impediment to capital formation in a jurisdiction of any tax type. You know, in a global economy where we have an open economy, which globalization is becoming the norm, capital is becoming more and more mobile. And as a result of that mobility, it's more sensitive to taxes than ever. So he really wanted a long-term solution combined with some triage, and we have some of those things I want to talk to Senator Links about, to kind of really, really change the dynamic in Minnesota and really, you know, say we're about long time, over the long haul, changing the job creation dynamic in Minnesota. And we kept coming back. We did research on other kinds of tax types. Is this the right tax to address? Should we go individual income tax to help pass through entities? Should we look at sales tax changes, maybe exempting business inputs? We looked at the whole waterfront of tax changes, and we kept coming back to the corporate franchise tax because the evidence, the economic research seemed to be the most compelling. And I'm not talking about economists that only write for the Cato. I'm talking about guys like Larry Summers. I'm talking about, you know, Charlie McClure. The weight of the evidence out there is that in a global climate, global environment, a corporate franchise tax is a real impediment to job creation. So that's why the governor went in this direction. And it's not, I'll stipulate, it's not a short-term fix. Absolutely is not, and it wasn't intended to be a short-term fix.
Commissioner, when you talk about the corporate franchise tax, I mean, isn't the federal corporate tax much, much higher than our state one? And if you want to talk about a global impact, and as Minnesota or our country competes for capital with global players, I mean, isn't the impact of the federal corporate income tax much, much larger than anything we could do as a state?
Chairman Bach, you're right. I mean, the federal corporate tax rate is three times what the state tax rate is. But we don't operate in isolation. It's not only about our states that we're competing against. We're competing against, you know, lower-cost environments. And we've also looked, when this proposal came, I vetted this with the governor, also looked at what's going on as a general trend around the world and around the country. And just in the United States, we're seeing a general trend by Republicans as well as Democrats to address the corporate franchise tax. New Jersey, for example, Democratic governor just signed a law repealing the throwback rule in New Jersey. West Virginia is in the process of scaling back their corporate franchise tax. Massachusetts, another, you know, relatively liberal state from a political standpoint, is going to combine reporting, but in conjunction with that is lowering the corporate franchise tax rate. The governor of South Carolina is just coming out with a plan over 10 years to completely eliminate the corporate franchise tax. So we're seeing a general trend. I think that the evidence is out there that this is really a harmful tax in the economy we operate in today. And people are taking, are listening to that evidence and adjusting their tax policies. And then you layer on top of that all the other inherent deficiencies in the corporate franchise tax. And we're all, so many onions, Kimmy, are familiar with them. It's a regressive tax. If you look at the Suits Index, it's more regressive than the property tax. And if you drill down on the property tax and look at the homestead property tax, after you factor in the PTR, it's more regressive than homeowner property taxes. So it is a very regressive tax that falls primarily on labor and consumers. Then on top of that, it's volatile. We talk about the volatility of the tax. The Department of Finance has done a lot of research on this. It's three times more volatile than the income tax. It's something like six times more volatile than the sales tax. So it's not a reliable revenue source to do budgeting around. And so when you make the entire case, the economic development case, coupled with the compliance costs associated with this tax, it's by far, on a dollar-for-dollar basis, the most expensive tax we administer. We have complex litigation we're involved in, time-consuming litigation. Most of it's the result of our corporate franchise tax. The private sector compliance costs for this tax are much higher than other tax types. And when you add up the cost benefit of this tax, and at the end of the day, you only generate 7% of your general fund revenues from this revenue source, it's hard to make a compelling case that this is a tax that we should continue to rely on. And so I think we looked at the whole case for the corporate franchise tax, and we said, you know what, we need to do something to address this over the long haul. And that's how we came to this proposal, the phase down.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just be very brief. We had a very compelling presentation from some economists in this committee about a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, I can't recall. And sometimes I feel like when we have this conversation, we're a hammer running around looking for a nail. And this whole conversation gets blown up to be the grand solution. I think I'm more looking forward to Commissioner McElroy's presentation. I think if we really want to make a difference in the business climate in this state, I agree. We can look at our tax policies and our regulatory policies. But let's also look at the University of Minnesota. Why aren't we commercializing research over there? Let's look at our transportation infrastructure, our education infrastructure, our environmental climate, our quality of life climate, those sorts of things. I think that's what we find more compelling in Minnesota about creating a business climate. I think, in this year in which we have a crisis and we have a governor running around talking about how we have the third worst business climate in the world. Apparently he's never been to Bangladesh or places where they just have muddy ruts for roads and no university infrastructure and no environmental regulation. So, let's have this conversation. That's fine. Let's have it with the facts, as Senator Rest has requested and Senator Ortman has requested. Let's really put the facts on the table. But let's also have it in the context of the crisis that we're experiencing this year. Why are we underperforming the rest of the country in job creation? We never used to be like that, Minnesota. Why are we outperforming the country in job losses? Why isn't our university converting research into business opportunities? I think that's a more interesting conversation to have about our business climate. We can do this, and by Commissioner Innes's own testimony, this is a long-haul, long-term prospect, and it's a volatile source that represents a tiny part of our budget. So let's not blow this whole subject out of proportion.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner, as you know, I support and have for many years abolishing the corporate income tax, franchise tax, for many of the same reasons that you just detailed. And quite frankly, if there were other ways of balancing at this point the contribution of the business community to our revenue resources, I would be far more interested in if the governor had repealed the corporate income tax, both as a long-term benefit to the state's economy, as well as the what we would assume would be the short-term stimulative effect. It is not a good way to raise money from the business community. It is regressive, and there are other regressive taxes. Some of the other ones are far more stable than this, and it seems to me that those taxes and tax systems, which we all know are so volatile, those are the ones that we should be looking at reducing and not letting them play a devilish part in our revenue estimates and our forecasts. But why not by 2015, even if that way, why not propose getting rid of it? Why should we have a rate of 4.8% 7 years from now? Why not a rate of 0%? You mentioned that governor of some state is ratcheting things down and getting to a repeal. I'd be interested in knowing, I don't remember which one it was because you mentioned several. Mm-hmm. I would be interested in knowing if that state is proposing that the business community writ large and corporations not participate at all in contributing revenues to the state, or whether that state has found a different way for them to do that.
Chairman, Senator Rest, I spoke of South Carolina.
South Carolina.
Yep, and the governor's proposed elimination of the corporate income tax over 10 years. And I believe the primary revenue source that's replacing that is actually increasing the cigarette tax. And their cigarette tax is one of the lowest in the country. Well, I think they're going to ratchet that up. There may be a secondary source as well, but I think the primary one is in fact the cigarette tax.
Well, but Mr. Chairman, that tax is maybe for South Carolina because it has such a low rate. They certainly can't claim that that source of revenue is going to be anything, if not more volatile, as people cut back on their smoking. And right now what the federal government just raised at another 61 cents in the S-CHIP proposal. So that's no solution, that's certainly not for Minnesota.
Commissioner, I think I think most of us around this table understand the volatility of the corporate tax. And I mean, I expressed to the business partnership last spring that I'd be willing to enter a new discussion about reducing the corporate income tax, but that before we sit down at the table, we have to agree that we're going to replace the revenue. And I think that's the problem with the governor's proposal, is it adds over $400 million in the next biennium to the deficit, because he doesn't propose replacing the lost revenue. And I think if we want to have a serious discussion about the corporate income tax, we got to put some offsetting revenue on the table. And I think if people are willing to do that, this committee is probably going to do some good work. But unless we can do that, just piling an additional $410 million onto the deficit in 12 and 13 is I just don't think it's any place we should go.
Now, Chairman, once again, I would just say that if this session is just about balancing the budget and maybe doing some short-term triage, it's really a mistake. And you know, the cost is not insignificant, there's no question about it, but I think the benefit that will accrue by going down this road and doing this, adopting this policy, outweighs the cost of the budget in the short term.
But Commissioner, we've got some very, very, you know, I understand that we've got some very, very serious short-term problems for businesses in this state. I mean, as I was at the post office the other day in my little hometown, and the hardware store owner came to me and he says, "Tom, is there going to be anything in this stimulus to help me? Little mom-and-pop hardware store." He said, "Senator, by spring I'm going to be closed because the door is just not opening." And we can talk about long-term lofty goals about doing good things for the Wells Fargos and the Targets of the world, but we are going to lose tens of thousands of small businesses on main streets in this state. So I think we need to be careful thinking so long-term that we lose sight of the fact of what's happening back in our communities. The state's got a serious fiscal crisis on its hands, and many of our businesses, tens of thousands of our businesses in this state, have a serious fiscal crisis on our hands. So, Commissioner, let's be careful about not looking too far and try to manage. Let's try to manage the short term first. And I think the challenges are pretty large, and I'm going to appreciate visiting with former Representative McElroy and Commissioner about that.
Chairman Bond, I concur 100% that we have extreme short-term fiscal challenges. I think the most detrimental thing to those small businesses you talk about will be raising the cost of their doing business, and that would be a tax increase. It would probably be the most detrimental thing in the short term for those businesses. And to Senator Langstedt's point, you know, the corporate franchise tax has got a lot of attention in the governor's proposal. But there's a number of other provisions in the governor's budget that are designed to help small businesses. 179 expensing. Most glamorous provision in the governor's tax bill, but clearly a provision that primarily, almost exclusively, benefits small businesses. There is a refundable investment tax credit in here that if a small business under 100 employees invests in the next 90 days, they get a refundable tax credit. Even those businesses don't have a net tax liability, they're going to get a $5,000 check if they maximize the credit. There's an angel investment credit that's designed to target help towards small businesses. There's a Small Business Investment Act, which I know the chair is familiar with. It is designed to help small businesses get capital to small businesses. So there's a whole litany of proposals in here, and the vast majority of them are designed to help small businesses, not large businesses. You know, another point about the corporate franchise tax, we are lucky to have these large, you know, world-class global corporations. When I was an employee of Deed, I spent a lot of time traveling around the state going to small and medium-sized manufacturers. I think I saw every widget imaginable being made. And I asked one question every time I was there: who are your customers? Who are your primary customers? And without fail, almost every one of those manufacturers had a customer, Medtronic. They represent 70% of my sales. We make the roll bar for Polaris. They represent 65% of our sales. If we lose them, I'd have to lay off half my folks. So we talk about not wanting to help the big guys, but the big guys, the big corporations, have ancillary benefits for the small guys, for those small manufacturers all over the state. One company I think we remember, 80% of their revenues were attributable to making the small plastic case that the Medtronic defibrillator fits in. And they said, that's 70% of our revenues. If we lose the Medtronic account, we close the doors. So, you know, we can talk about 80% of the corporate franchise taxes being paid by the big guys, so they're going to accrue all this benefit. But there is a benefit to the small and medium-sized companies that are struggling out there for the large corporations to prosper, because that is their customer base.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, we should just be very clear that in order to avail itself of a tax credit, a small business must have money. There's no money in the economy. They don't have cash, and they don't have credit. So they're not going to buy the new equipment and get the tax credit. So I think we're fooling ourselves. If we don't get some cash into the economy through stimulus, nothing's going to change anytime soon. And so I think we should be looking at tax refunds for individuals. And I think I would hope that you would go back and look at that at the Department of Revenue, because we need to have cash in the economy for people to buy things, to support the small businesses, to go into the grocery store and buy groceries, to save money to buy down debt, to save for a car. But those small businesses, those tax credits don't mean a lot if they aren't succeeding right now. If they're in jeopardy now, those tax credits will provide no relief.
Well,
Commissioner.
Sure, who's the chairman now? Let's go. I'd say chairman. Chairman, Senator Ortman, you know, the feedback we've gotten from our package is contrary to what you just articulated. We've talked to a lot of small business folks. When we were putting this package together, we reached out to the business associations, the different groups that represent the whole waterfront of businesses. And they said upfront exemption on capital equipment will help us in the short term. The ones that we're not expensing will help us in the short term, even those who are struggling. The refundable tax credit to incent people to make some investments, because credit is tight. So we get them a refundable tax credit, so even if they don't have a tax liability, they're going to get some money in their pockets. And the other parts of the package, that's contrary to what we heard, that they need some help. They need some help in the short term, and those provisions will help them weather the storm until the economy turns around. It may not be the determining factor for their survival, but it will help them weather the storm.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langseth.
Mr. Chair, you know, the tax rates are one thing. The effective rates are another. We have a 9.8% rate. If you divide the taxes that are paid by corporations into the total corporate income, what is the effective rate?
You know, we've tried
Commissioner.
To do, I'm sorry, Chairman, Senator Langseth, we try to do some research on exactly how we compare from our effective rate. And there's no question the effective rate is substantially less than the statutory rate of 9.8. No question about it, Senator Langseth. And we're doing our best to try to find a way to compare our effective rate relative to other jurisdictions, state and. It's difficult, though, because there's so much complexity in the corporate tax. Everybody has a substantially different base. So I think we might end up measuring as a percent of GDP, something along those lines. But we're going to try to get an accurate reflection of where we rate as far as more of an effective tax rate, because it is the statutory rate is not. It's a relevant measurement, but it certainly doesn't tell the whole story. You're absolutely right, Senator.
Well, Mr. Chair, when it comes to the regular income tax, I had read someplace one time that the actual effective rate, if you take the total income tax people pay into their income, was 2.1%, 2.2%, something like that. And I think, I mean, that is what people pay. When I was first in the legislature, we had a 17% income tax rate. The highest effective rate was 11.5%. Now we got a 7.85%, and the highest effective rate is around 6%. So as far as what people are paying, the rate is not much more than half.
Right.
And I guess what baffles me is that when we went through these years of very high taxes, we had a very strong economy. And now all the emphasis has been on lowering those, and now our whole economy is falling apart, both federally and statewide. I really, taxes are an issue. I know that. But I think there's been way too much emphasis on the taxes people pay versus everything else. Because I think the number one problem with businesses, and many businessmen have said this, or business people, okay, is a trained quality workforce. That's number one. And I think we're squeezing this to the point where we're going to have a very difficult time doing that because of the lack of revenue.
Chairman, Senator Langseth, your point is absolutely well taken. When I was at DEDA and met with businesses who were thinking about making investments in Minnesota or moving a headquarters here or siting a plant here, without fail, the number one inquiry they had is, do we have a robust labor pool that meets the needs of the workers we need? Undoubtedly, the number one inquiry every time. But right behind that, second or third, was almost always cost of doing business, and that usually related to the tax climate and the regulatory climate. So you're right. I mean, the taxes isn't the end-all, be-all. It's not the only metrics that matters for a business. Skilled labor force is still number one, far and away number one. I think Commissioner McElroy will concur with that. But I think we have gotten somewhat complacent. I was probably guilty of it when I was at D, because I made our labor force my number one point every time I tried to close a deal with an employer. You know, we have one of the best labor forces in the world. It's skilled. It has a high work ethic. It's high participation rates. And it's not just in the metro area, the whole state. We have a great labor force. But I think Minnesota has gotten complacent, thinking that's the ultimate trump card, that we can rely on our labor force to get these jobs, that businesses should be honored to do business in Minnesota because we have this great workforce. But at the end of the day, cost of doing business and price matters. And it may be the second or third consideration, but it's relevant. And so I think we need to continue to invest in our skilled labor force, but we need to do something on the price, especially in this global economy. Even in 10 years, the world has changed a lot. Made it a more global economy today than it was a decade ago. So I think we got to be more cognizant of price than we were in the past.
Commissioner, why don't we get going on the governor's recommendations on provisions in the tax area?
Sure.
And maybe, Commissioner McElroy, why don't you come on up, and as we go down, maybe we can have you join in.
And, Chairman, I don't know the best way you want to tackle this. You know, I know you all have copies of legislation in front of you, a draft, but you also have these change pages from the governor's budget, and that might be the easiest way to go through the recommendations. Cross-reference the language if you'd like and ask any questions. But the individual provisions start on page 6 of the change pages, the one that looks like this. And we've already spoken about the corporate franchise tax reduction. As you all know, it's a little more than a 50% reduction over 6 years, beginning in tax year 2010. Full percentage point in 2010, another percentage point in 2011. The following 2 years, a half point, and then another full point to finally rest at 4.8%. So just a little over a 50% reduction.
Moving on.
The next page is a reinvestment tax credit. And this is the one that I spoke to Senator Langseth. This is a refundable tax credit that is intended to spur investment in the short term. And what we're looking at is about a 90-day window. If you make an investment in July 1st, in the next 90 days, you will get a 25% tax credit up to $5,000. We will bifurcate that from the tax return, so they won't have to wait until they file a return the following year. They'll get the money right away. We've capped it at $50 million just due to fiscal constraints, and we're not quite sure what the appetite will be for it, so we capped it at $50 million. The sort of investments that will be eligible for that are things that the 179 is eligible for. So it includes a whole laundry list of tangible personal property, everything from computers to cash registers to furniture to vehicles, would be eligible for this refundable tax credit. And it's really a way to try to provide some short-term relief to small businesses. You get the full credit if you're 100 employees or less. If you're 110 employees, you get 20% credit. So it's scaled. But it's really an attempt to provide some short-term relief to small businesses.
Commissioner, what's the cap that any one business can receive?
It's $5,000.
Senator Rest.
Commissioner, are there similar provisions in the federal bill, either for investment credits, short-term investment credits, or 100% expensing? Could someone purchase something and end up not paying anything for it?
You know, Chairman, Senator Rest, I'm not sure about all the particular provisions in the federal stimulus package. I need to look at that. I do know they're doing something on the 179 expensing, and they're ratcheting up the amount that can be expensed.
Mr. Chairman, I think we need to pay careful attention to the federal stimulus tax provisions, and if there's a really good thing there and we don't need to repeat it, then that's a way of having of using what they're doing to help Minnesota businesses where maybe we don't need to make this $50 million. Obviously, it's scalable, but I think we need to make sure that we don't duplicate things when we're not going to get a much bigger bang for the buck. I say use the federal money, not change a state tax policy if it's duplicative.
Moving along.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Dan McElroy, the Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And the next change page reflects two tax credits that were developed in our agency. But they're ideas that have been around in other forms in other years. The first one, the Job Creation Investment Tax Credit, is a proposal for individual angel investors, a 25% tax credit for investments in funds that make qualified business investments. There are provisions to have those spread broadly across the state. We have proposed a limit of $200,000 for individuals and $1 million for funds. We have a little concern that this may be too large, and we'll look forward to that debate or that discussion here. You may recall there was a similar provision in the 2008 tax bill, but limited to the five border cities in western Minnesota. The second credit is the Small Business Investment Tax Credit. It's a $38 million in tax incentives over 4 years, results in about $63 million in investment. It's a credit against the insurance gross, company's gross premiums tax for investments in small business investment companies. In some states, these are called capital companies. The intention is to make both of these is to make more capital available for early stage business and job creation and venture creation in Minnesota. I know this committee has heard in the past, and we have certainly heard, that traditional venture capital has moved to larger investments in later stage companies. And the governor wants to thank previous authors of these bills. Senator Bach, you authored one. Others in the room have authored other bills along around this topic. We think this has some capacity, both short and long term, to increase jobs in Minnesota.
Yeah, members, we're going to be hearing this bill. Senator Saltzman is the author of this bill this year, something I carried last year. So, I mean, the problem is there is significant tails in this proposal. But that doesn't mean I think we shouldn't have a discussion about whether some investment here could stimulate some economic activity. Commissioner, go ahead.
The next proposal is a green job zone. This idea came to us from Senator Alan Anderson, who proposed it during the last legislative session. It's to create a tax-free zone around the new green economy. We have used the definition that it would create tax-free zones in renewable energy, manufacturing equipment or services used in renewable energy, or for companies that create products or service that lessens energy use or emissions, so a heavy emphasis on conservation and recycling. The estimated cost is about $3.75 million in the first biennium of the budget period, about $6.6 billion in the out biennium. These are different than the governor's current job opportunity building zones in that they could be located anywhere in the state, including the metropolitan area, and that we would not be predetermining acreage. These would be based on applications by cities or other economic development agencies to fit a particular project, and would provide similar tax exemptions to the types of exemptions offered currently. Upfront sales tax exemption on equipment, on construction materials, and then an ongoing property tax exemption and corporate or personal business-related income tax. We have had a huge number of calls from prospective companies that have an interest in a variety of industries. I'd have to say the largest number of phone calls have been in both solid and liquid biofuels. These tend to be fairly portable. They can be in a variety of states where there is feedstock available. And the idea of a tax-exempt zone for green investment has caused a fair amount of interest and activity so far, Mr. Chairman.
So, Commissioner, would biomass type, the renewable fuel type project, would that qualify for something like this?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it would.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We don't necessarily have to get into the weeds. I love the green. Don't know if I'm crazy about the job Z. How do we respond to some of the critiques and criticisms that various economists and our own legislative auditor have outlined for us about job Z and whether or not we're just kind of moving pieces around on a chessboard? I mean, the whole notion of a green job is, just had this discussion actually with my neighbor, what is a green job, getting our arms around that, it's more of an art than a science. It's a job, and it's a way of talking about some of the emerging innovations, technologies, market opportunities. So there's nothing magic about green jobs, and so how do we know that green job Z is going to be so much better than the job Z concept that we're already very familiar with?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, first of all, in response to the legislative auditor's suggestions, we've made 30-some changes to the program to tighten up some of the concerns, very legitimate concerns, that were brought to our attention. Under the original law, the state did not have the authority to approve or deny a state or a city's business subsidy agreement. We have that now. And we can require a positive return on investment from new projects, and we are doing that. Those kinds of safeguards will be included in the legislation for the green job zones. We also have the opportunity to work on the definition. We adapted in the proposed legislation a very narrow definition of what a green job is, just because of the concern that you outlined. Would a company that printed instruction manuals on how to change light bulbs to more energy-efficient light bulbs be a green job? And we have said no, it would not. So we're trying for a narrow definition. It will certainly be a debate. One of the reasons that we think green zones are important is because the investments are so tremendously portable. Senator Bach raised the idea of a company started in Rosemont, Minnesota, by Endress Industries, or Endress, Inc., a major investment now of Cliffs Resources from Cleveland. But their first plants are in Michigan, one in Battle Creek and one in Marquette. They can be any place that they want them to be, and we do have to provide, we believe, some incentives to have them here. That one has a fairly significant capital cost. As I recall, Mr. Chairman, it's about $15 million in capital for each plant. We're talking to other companies where the capital is $250 or $350 or $500 million in the case of biorefineries, and there will be a lot of states that want those. And so we believe that this is a good way to incent those to take place in Minnesota.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just reflect on my earlier comments. I just want to be sure we're not hammers running around looking for nails, and that there is the Green Job Task Force report coming forward, and it talks a little bit about some tax policy, talks a little bit about regulatory policy, but I want to be really sure that we're not simply stealing from other parts of the state or giving folks tax breaks for stuff that they would already be doing. And I want to be sure that an economic development strategy is a smart one, and it's comprehensive, and it's not just focused on stuff that's not going to get us the return that we're looking for. It's about identifying existing strengths, emerging opportunities, chain of supply, industry clusters, research that's going on at our university, the workforce that we're mobilizing, the infrastructure that we need to support that. That's aligning an economic development strategy. And if we're really focused on something like this, we're just not going to get there. We're going to continue to have more of the same that we've experienced in recent years.
Mr. Chairman, one other difference in this proposal is that it does not include benefits for relocations. We've had some challenges in the original job opportunity building zones of providing incentives for people to move businesses to one side of the community, from one side of the community to another, or from one community in a labor shed to another. We do not include that opportunity in this proposal.
Commissioner, how do we, and as much as I'd like to help Renewal Fuel, I mean, I know the principals very well, and we provided them with some language in last year's tax bill to use some taconite tax money as a low-interest loan to them. The project's been announced, clearly underway. How do we make sure that under this proposal we're not going to subsidize projects that are going to happen anyway? I mean, that was one of the legislative auditor's concerns about in his report, that I want to say the number was like 19% of the projects were going to happen anyway, but took advantage of the benefits. How do we make sure we don't just create an additional incentive for things that were going to happen anyway?
Mr. Chairman, I'm afraid I don't have a perfect answer for that. We've struggled with that with tax increment financing since that idea originated, and it had the but-for test. But for the provision of this incentive, would it happen, or would it happen here, or would it happen at this scale? One of the things that compels me to think that the green zones are important is the fact that these jobs are perhaps more geographically portable than they are in some other industries we compete in, and that the particularly on the liquid biofuel side, but to some extent on the solid fuel side, the capital investments are so large. But I don't have a magic answer for you. We will keep working for ways to provide that assurance.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner McElroy. You know, we had a presentation in Jobs Committee just yesterday, I think, and they talked about renewable fuels and other presentations I've heard. They talk about the renewable fuels for cellulosic and that stuff, which I know is a little ways off, but it's going to locate where the feedstock is, and it's because of the freight on shipping this stuff. So is any of this job or Green Z stuff going to be beneficial to the people or the place that's producing the feedstocks? Because if it's true that they're going to locate where the feedstocks are, maybe we should target our emphasis on developing that early part of it and letting some of the rest of it play itself out on its own.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, we've been involved in some of those same discussions, and that because the feedstocks are not very dense and fairly expensive to transport, that at least some of them are likely to occur in greater Minnesota, but they could also occur in greater South Dakota or greater any place, and there's a limited amount of capital available in this stage of the development of renewable fuels. We're almost competing for the capital as much as we are for anything else. And I think the jobs will come where the value is added, and if, for example, a cellulosic ethanol plant, and we have two of them moving along moderately rapidly, one in Little Falls and one in Benson, those are likely to have jobs relatively close to the creation of the biomass. Solid fuels may be a little different than that, because the liquid biofuels at some point may be a blending agent and they move by rail tank cars. I'm interested in learning. I learned recently that 50% of the homes in Sweden and Finland are fueled with solid, or heated rather, with solid fuel. Mostly wood pellets, but increasingly pellets made from mixed municipal solid waste or sewage treatment sludge or a variety of other things. So the opportunities, there are going to be opportunities for a variety of companies to provide energy sources, some of which will be used in metro areas, but some of which have the potential to be used in lots of other places. I think solid home heating fuels will likely take place first in places where people now heat with propane and fuel oil because of the cost. And that will speak to those things happening in greater Minnesota. We're seeing a little of that now, but it's been relatively slow to emerge. I do have to share, Mr. Chairman, I asked a Swedish entrepreneur why they had gotten so far ahead in solid fuel. And he said, well, we started a long time ago, for one thing, and they have a lot of trees and a lot of wood waste. But they had a national aversion to heating with natural gas because they would have had to buy it from Norway. And we heard something similar to that in Finland, and they would have had to buy it from Russia. And so they had something of a national loyalty to fuel they could produce locally.
Mr. Chair, I can certainly understand the Swedish aversion to all things Norwegian.
Commissioner? Sir?
Mr. Chairman, I'm very interested in this, and maybe the question belongs in Senator Metzen's committee, and you, Senator Skoy, and I serve on that. I don't recall hearing this bill, though, last year from Senator Anderson. So I'm wondering, frankly, if it's enough. I mean, you're talking about some of these businesses investing $250, $300 million. I mean, that, I don't know if that's just their startup, but that's maybe the total investment. But what can we do with $3.5 million if we're doing a number of businesses? That's maybe I'm missing something here, but it seems like it's a pretty small amount. And what are other states doing, if we know?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Shy, I do not know what other states are doing, but I will, and we will find out. I believe this bill was only heard in Senator Anderson's committee last year. I don't know if it came to the Tax Committee or not. If it did, it may have been later in the session. This is the cost is the Department of Revenue's estimate of what would occur in the early years. One of the interesting things is if we land a biorefinery, it takes a couple of years to get it permitted and designed. So the cost to the state occurs a couple of years out in its life cycle because that's when construction actually occurs. Even a product as relatively simple as Renewa Fuels, which is a compressed wood or paper waste used in place of coal in either a power plant or a taconite mill kiln or a cogen facility, they're probably looking at a year of engineering and permitting prior to construction.
Okay.
I think that's their expectation.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Mark Loftus from Deed. To the Senator Shai's question about the cost of Job Z and how that number could equate to the types of investments we might have, when we work with revenue on the estimate, we had projected, I believe, in fiscal 10, 5 projects, and in fiscal 11, 12, 13 after 10 projects. And it was based on a prototypical manufacturing project, maybe not a large biofuel project, but a typical project of the kind that we anticipate. Also, and that also indicates at a relatively smaller scale the number of projects that we anticipate under this program. It equates to the commissioner's point about trying to hone down the number of projects that we think are truly needing the benefit. As we examine each project and approve it, as we now are, we anticipate fewer projects than we did under the original Job Z.
Thanks.
Mr. Loftus, as much scrutiny and frankly criticism that there's been about the effectiveness of Job Z, why did we call this Green Job Z? I mean, it's not a zone. It's a project. I mean, they're individual businesses. Wouldn't it have been better to give it a different name rather than right away throw it into the pot as just an extension of Job Z, which has frankly been questionable?
Senator, we're open to call it something else. That's probably a good suggestion. It was called that because it had some similarity to the previous program. Calling it something else is probably a good idea. I think Senator Anderson called them green job. I think she used the term zone, as I recall.
Green economy tax credits.
But we're open to call it whatever works.
Page 11, Commissioner.
Chairman, yeah, page 11 is the governor's recommendation to go to an upfront exemption for the capital equipment sales tax exemption. It's something I think there's universal agreement this is the right policy. It's always been a casualty of budget constraints. So this under the governor's proposal, any purchase made after January 1st of 2010 would be an upfront exemption, and the Department of Revenue would get out of the business of cutting refund checks to taxpayers.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, it's this kind of policy that I think would speak to what Senator Ortman talked about earlier, and that is if they didn't have to pay it to start with, they'd have cash in hand in order to make their investments or to hire people. And it's also a long-term policy. So in my mind, if we were going to choose between doing the capital equipment upfront exemption, which is available to all businesses regardless of their structure, as opposed to the phase-out of the phase-out, not getting rid of it, I'm for getting rid of it, but the phase-out, that this would be much bigger bang for your buck. And then, but then I have a question. In your description, you talk about the relationship to the base budget that it references not only the general sales tax, but then the sales tax amendment that we just passed as having an impact on the general fund, and I understand that part. Mm-hmm. But in figuring the revenue estimate, does the local taxes come into that as well? Like in suburban Hennepin County, we pay for the stadium and we pay for the transit tax. Is that also part of the revenue estimate, even though they're only local taxes?
Right. Chairman, Senator Rest, yes, it is.
All of it. So yep. No matter where. I mean, in Duluth or Minneapolis or suburban Hennepin County or any of the other counties or areas. So all of it, not just a tax that's applied statewide, has gone into the estimate. Is that correct?
Yep, Chairman, Senator Rest, I believe that's correct. I'll confirm that with Dr. Wilson, but I'm pretty sure that's because we're the administrator of all the local option sales taxes.
Right, I understand that.
And so we would be the one to cut the refund check for the entire amount of the sales tax.
But because you just referenced it relative to the base budget, I just want to be sure that estimate includes an upfront exemption number for the local tax.
I don't clarify that, Senator.
So, Commissioner, the cost of this to the state's general fund may be less than what we see on the note.
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah,
exactly.
I will determine that. I'll have to double check. Have to double check the local option.
Commissioner, I've always, and I think most people on this table have always thought this would be the right policy, and I guess I want to keep the dialogue open as to how we could figure out how we could pay for this, because I do think this would provide some economic stimuluses to the business community in the very short run.
Yeah, I mean, everybody that
happen
makes purchases
very quickly. Senator Dibble?
Well, thank you. Two things. One is I'm glad you raised the subject of the local sales taxes, because I think we need to understand the fiscal. We just need to know what the fiscal implication is for, you know, the local sales taxes, including the metro area transit quarter cent. I'm particularly interested in, you know, what the order of magnitude is there. But I agree this may be a good thing, but again, you know, this is not a silver bullet and it needs to be taken into context. I understand we can only talk about one thing at a time, but businesses need to be doing business. They need customers, they need business prospects, you know, because they're going to be spending money in order to see this relief, and so hopefully we're looking at this in the context of our overall business climate, creating economic activity, because, you know, they certainly don't realize any tax relief unless they're actually buying and investing in capital equipment, and if they have no reason to because they have no customers, no prospects, it means nothing to them.
But members and commissioner, if there ever was a time to do this, I can't imagine that it's ever scored less money than this, because we anticipate less capital investment.
Right.
I mean, I think this was scoring well over $100 million 2 years ago when we looked at trying to do this. This would probably be the time to try and figure it out. And because really what we're asking businesses to do is essentially send some money to the state as a loan, and if you have enough accounting staff and you apply for the refund, we're going to give it back to you. But really, we're asking businesses from a cash flow standpoint to provide money to the state for the short term, and then some businesses get it back, but many don't, and most that don't are smaller businesses. They don't have the accounting staff to get through the – and we saw the testimony, the volume of pages that businesses have to go through to submit for the refund. Is that interesting?
Well, just another benefit is if we do it when it doesn't cost as much, when the economy recovers, it's just carried as a tax expenditure, and it's not in the budget. So this is a good time to do it,
right,
if we can.
Senator Scheid?
No, I'm just waving.
Chairman, I couldn't concur more. First of all, this policy is long overdue. We should have done it, but we had fiscal realities we had to confront. I think you're right. This is the time, the opportunity to do it. And as to Senator Rest's point, all businesses would benefit from this provision, but it really is primarily an issue for small businesses. They just don't have the manpower to do the paperwork necessary. It's a cash flow issue for them. We do our best to get all the refunds are out pretty much within 90 days, and about 40% of them are out within 30 days. We call them quick refunds. But still, it's a 30-day wait that they shouldn't have to wait for, ultimately.
Commissioner, page 12.
Yep.
Just
Senator Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, on the sales tax refund, do you have a percentage that's paid back? I mean, is it 90% or 85, or do you know that? I mean, because there are some people that don't apply to it.
There's always, as you probably can see, even on our revenue estimate, the cost is for perpetuity, because there's always a shift cost, but part of that is also a non-compliance cost, I'd call. People just decline to apply for the refund just because they don't have the resources or they just neglect to do it. So I can try to talk to Dr. Wilson and get a breakdown of that, because part of that ongoing cost in the out years is a shift, like a permanent shift cost. The remainder of it, though, is people just decline to apply for the refund. And I'll get that breakdown for you. Page 12, Chairman, is the 179 expensing. This is full conformity with the 179 expensing provisions, federal conformity. As we've stated before, this is primarily going to benefit small businesses who are making investments in their business. The expenses that are eligible for this provision is a broad range of things, and it's mostly, you know, tangible personal property type of items. But it's something the business community has really wanted us to do, full conformity. Farmers are also a primary beneficiary of this provision. So the governor is recommending full conformity. Page 13 is a very targeted capital gains exclusion that the governor is advocating for. And it would be targeted at small businesses of less than 100 employees. And if an equity investment was made in these small businesses, there would be a 50% exclusion if they held the investment for a minimum of 5 years. So you see there's no cost in the next two bienniums, but there would be a cost in the out bienniums. And at this point, Dr. Wilson hasn't scored that. It's a relatively speculative number. We don't know how many takers there would be for this. But it's something I think the governor, I think it's consistent with some of his other policies, Angel Investment Credit, the Small Business Investment Act, a way to infuse these small businesses with additional investment capital and provide an incentive for people to invest in these smaller businesses. And it's very surgical. It's you can't be a certain types of businesses are excluded from the benefit. So it's really meant to try to benefit small manufacturers and small businesses.
Commissioner, this might be a good idea, but we have to have some idea what it's going to cost. So if you could get something from Dr. Wilson as to what it's going to be in the out years, I think it's pretty hard to consider not having any idea what it's potentially could cost.
Right.
Just a range of cost, I think.
Chairman, your point is well taken. We'll come up with a range, what we think, based on some assumptions that we think are reasonable.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, back to the Section 179. I understand. I think the federal law has reduced that number from 250 down to some smaller number in 09. Do you know, is there any discussion at the level going back to 250, which would affect your revenue estimate here?
Correct. And I believe in the federal stimulus package as it's proceeding right now, there is an increase in the amount of the expensing amount. So if that does, in fact, pass, we will have to recalibrate our revenue estimate or decide to do less than full conformity if the cost is prohibitive.
Thank you.
14, you know, Senator, Chairman Bach, I'm going to try to talk about the next four or five pages together, because it includes the county program aid, the LGA cuts, the market value credit reductions, they're all put together as a package, I would say, so I want to talk to them kind of in a systematic way. We structured these county program aid cuts and the LGA cut, the market value credit reductions, in a similar manner to what we did in 2003. And we backloaded the cuts in the second year, so there's a more significant cut in the second year, an acknowledgement that cities and counties have already set their budgets and don't have a lot of budgetary flexibility to absorb a large cut. So we backloaded the cut. We capped the amount of the cut as a percentage of their levy plus aid. And I can walk through that. For cities, for example, in Pay 09, the cap is 5.05% of their levy plus aid. In the second year, it goes up to 10.55% of levy plus aid. That's a reflection of the cut being backloaded in the second year. For counties, it's a little more complicated picture in that the county's Pay 09 cut is 1.53% of levy plus aid, and then second year, 2.8%. That assumes that they'll participate in this county health care consolidation proposal that DHS is working on. And we believe that this is a reasonable assumption that they'll participate. The initial benchmarks are fairly reasonable to obtain, and if they meet those benchmarks, they buy back a portion of the cut. In November of this year, they just need to make an indication to the Department of Health and Human Services that they intend to participate in the consolidation process. In June of 10, they need to pass a resolution and send that to the Department of Health and Human Services that they are still working towards consolidation. And then the following year is kind of where the rubber hits the road, and they have to pass a joint powers agreement by June of 2011 to participate in the consolidation. And if they meet each of those benchmarks, each year they buy back a large percentage. You can see in the change pages, a large percentage of the county program aid cut. So we're assuming full participation, and that's reflected in the 2.41% reduction in 09 and the 2.8 production in 02, I'm sorry. If you look at that over the biennium, it represents a 23% cut in LGA and a 27.4% cut in county program aid. Then the other component of the cut is the market value credit. As you remember, in 03, we cut the market value credit. The argument was that everybody should have some skin in the game. If you're not an LGA-dependent city, then you should still absorb some of the cut, making some geographical equity to the overall package. So it works the same way as it did in 03. The LGA is the first thing to be taken. If there's not any LGA or it's not enough to reach the cap, then it spills over to the market value credit.
So, Commissioner, if the LGA cut is 23% over the biennium, what's the market value credit cut?
The market value credit, Chairman, the market value credit cut, for the homestead market value credit, it's 14%, Chairman, and for the ag market value credit, it's 18.3%, Chairman.
That's not what it says here. It says 13. Chairman, it says 13.1 and 17.2.
You know, I have another different spreadsheet I should probably reconcile, but I'm fairly confident for the biennium number.
Chairman, now, Commissioner, what's the number instead of the percentage?
Governor's Rex would... Okay, let me get the number here. I'm sorry. Net numbers. I'm sorry. I thought I had this readily available.
Can tell me later, but we have 32.7 million.
Yep, 32.7.
35,860.
For the market value credit on a base of 521.
And then that your note to the base budget says 13.1%.
And number I have on this spreadsheet is actually a 14.1, but I will reconcile that. Make sure we got the right numbers.
Same thing's true on the on the ag.
I'll have to consult Eric Ouellette and make sure I got the right numbers in front of us. But to the chairman's point, it is a less of a percent cut than the LGA and county program aid. There's one other component that I wanna bring to you. Eric, do you have those numbers? Okay. Sorry, Senator Ress, we will get those numbers to you today before the close of the day.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just it bears pointing out that Minneapolis is looking at a $35 million cut LGA, about 40% of its LGA. It's approaching half of the entire freight in these LGA cuts for 10. And I know Commissioner Hansen tried to say with a straight face at the table that the governor's decisions and our decisions of the state don't drive up other kinds of taxes, but when you're looking at cutting, you know, 40% of LGA, you're talking about cutting core and essential basic services that touch people's lives very directly. Public safety, public works, you know, the things that make our cities function effectively. Minneapolis in particular, as a regional center, not just the residents are affected, but our ability to be kind of the economic core of the region and deliver the sorts of aids that we do to the communities around us. So just, you know, that kind of, it will simply devastate the city of Minneapolis's general fund budget. It will drive up property taxes significantly, as is already happening, and has been happening for some time. So let's not suffer under some illusion that our decisions, the governor's decisions, don't create real consequence in terms of direct delivery of core services and how much they cost and how much we pay and how we pay for them.
Commissioner, are you available to come back Wednesday morning for an hour or so?
Absolutely, Chairman.
Members, I think we probably need to get up to the floor. We'll resume next Wednesday. We've got a small number of members' bills that we'll take in addition to picking up with the LGA discussion and the rest of the change items in the governor's proposal. Members, we have very few bills introduced to the Tax Committee. And I'm reluctant to spend much time hearing bills that have tax expenditures or tax exemptions that we actually have to score as spending. So I think unless somebody feels a strong desire to hear them, we probably won't spend any time on them. But if you could talk with your colleagues about getting, they have something laying on their desk that doesn't have a state general fund cost that they want to get introduced, we should get them in and start getting to work on them because we don't have very many. And if you have something or you know somebody who has something they'd like us to consider, we'd be helpful if we had a hearing request on it so we know that people are serious about it. Senator Raskin.
Mr. Chairman, how would you feel about putting a sales tax on golf fees?
Senator Rest, everything's on the
greens,
table.
On greens fees. Wouldn't that be lovely?
Somebody suggested to me that maybe if we could avoid a cut to the courts if we put a sales tax on attorneys.
There you go.
I think a lot of people have got a lot of ideas, and I think as we kind of stir them all up in a pot, we're gonna come up with some solutions by May that hopefully will make the state a better place. Senator Squay.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, particularly those of the property tax division, we have also not have a lot of activity going on there. And the issues that we do have, I think, are large enough that it would be better, as long as the full committee is not inundated with other work, that we would just do them in the full committee. Green Acres, impact of the governor's aid and county program aid cuts to levy. I think there's going to be some levy impact on this regionalization of the health and human services we're going to want to take a look at. I think as long as the workload of the full committee, we'll just do that in the full committee if the chair is agreeable.
Thank you, members. This committee is adjourned until Wednesday morning.